2 weeks ago on a Monday night, we started our coming and going session. So this marks the beginning of the third week. And we're entering into a discussion of the third section of this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that we've been studying and talking about. And this section is called Right Understanding. And I want to read a little portion, of course, as we've been doing, from Shinryu Suzuki. And I also want to, this is my intention anyway, I want to weave in two other elements that are very resonant with me today. One is that today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a holiday in the United States, in most states, with a few exceptions, because this is the United States of America, not always united. And the other thing I want to weave in is the fact, and you might detect it in my voice, that I have a cold. These three things have been percolating with me all day, and let's see how this all goes. Here's the selection from Shinryu Suzuki, which is from the first section in this third part, called Traditional Zen Spirit. And this is what he says. The understanding passed down from Buddha to our time is that when you start Zazen, there is enlightenment without any preparation. There is enlightenment even without any preparation. Whether you practice Zazen or not, you have Buddha nature. Because you have it, there is enlightenment in your practice. The points we emphasize are not the stage we attain, but the strong confidence we have in our original nature and the sincerity of our practice. We should practice Zen with the same sincerity as Buddha. If originally we have Buddha nature, the reason we practice Zazen is that we must behave like Buddha. To transmit our way is to transmit our spirit from Buddha. So this is one of those sections in this book and also in our teachings as Boundless Way Zen teachers that we say over and over and over again in various ways that everyone already has the Buddha nature, or as Dogen changed it, is the Buddha nature, is already manifesting as perfect and complete. But taking into account the other two elements that I wanted to weave in, Martin Luther King Jr. Day and my cold, we have to look at this Buddha nature in a very subtle way. The reality is that human beings don't appear to manifest as Buddhas. They don't appear to manifest as Buddhas partly because we have such a limited notion of what it means to be a Buddha. Dealing with a cold, and by my count right now, I think there are 5 of us here who have some sort of respiratory illness, which is interesting. My sense is that they're all unique to each one of us, which is the way viruses do mutate in bodies. When we have any kind of sickness, any kind of illness, any kind of personal bodily distress, we get to practice with that as Buddha. And that is not easy practice. It's not that when everything is fine, that's easy practice, because that has its own challenges. When we're healthy, when everything is fine, there's room for the mind to do its thing and wonder, how long will this last? Will I catch a cold from these horrible, phlegmy people who are occupying the temple right now? Gosh, I hope not. And yet, we are human beings in human bodies, so we are of the nature to have ill health, and this is something that we know, no matter how we attempt to narrow our definition of what it means to be a Buddha, that is, one who never gets sick. I've told this story before. A good friend of mine who has had cancer recur a number of times was doing a retreat at the Insight Meditation Society up the street, also on Pleasant Street, but in another town. And she started to feel poorly and called her doctor, and her doctor said, you should come home right away. your symptoms sound like this could be a recurrence of your lymphoma. So she decided to pack up all her stuff. She told the retreat leader she was leaving so she could go to the doctor and take care of this. This really for her was life and death. And as she was leaving, somebody met her on the path and said, "Where are you going?" And she said, "Well, I have to check this out. I might have a recurrence of my cancer." And the person who met her on the path said, "Oh, do you think that maybe you weren't meditating correctly?" This is a very strange thing to say, and yet it comes right from the idea of the limited nature of Buddha nature, that it only looks one way, that we can't possibly be sick. So if we get sick, maybe there's something wrong with us. That certainly arises in my mind when I get sick. I think there's something deficient. I always remember being at a mindfulness conference in Washington, D.C., where all these scientists were presenting various wonderful presentations about how mindfulness would make you healthier and more robust and live longer and have a stronger immune system. And this particular conference was attended by the Dalai Lama, the wonderful head of one of the Tibetan Buddhist schools, who most of us know as the Buddhist. If you ask somebody, "Do you know any Buddhists?" they always say, "The Dalai Lama." So he's very famous. And he listened patiently to everyone talking about how wonderful mindfulness is and how it could solve all your problems. And he had a bad cold. And I'll never forget him taking the microphone and putting it right up to his mouth and saying, "So we have to understand that maybe this practice is not about feeling better in the body." And I just loved that. I just thought that was so wonderful. Because maybe somebody in the audience thought, maybe the Dalai Lama isn't practicing meditation correctly. But this is correct practice. This is the way it is. And the third element I want to weave in, which really, to me, connects these two pieces, is the fact that it is the day we celebrate the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. I went online today to do a little investigation to see if I could find a particularly Buddhist-flavored quote from Martin Luther King, but I couldn't find one. And instead I found the a little notice that if he had lived, if he had not been murdered, he would be 81 on this birthday, still with us, still alive and probably making lots of trouble. Someone really needed in these difficult days of the United States of America, as he was needed in the 1950s and 1960s. It's hard to believe that he is someone who is our age, or at least close to it, or would have been. Not a person from the distant past, but our contemporary. And he was someone who saw the world through a very interesting lens. He saw, and maybe this is where there is some connection, he saw the world through the lens of love and justice. And he didn't see that love and justice were separate from each other. I did find one quote where he said something like, "I have chosen the path of love because that path of hate is too much of a burden." When we think about the situation in the world right now and in this country, and how hatred seems to have taken hold of a large segment of the population, as happens with human beings, we have to wonder how the path of love could possibly be helpful. We have to wonder how our lives could be impacted by choosing love rather than hate. And there's a clue in what Shinryu Suzuki talks about, as well as a clue in the passage that I had us read during our sutra service, our little mini sutra service earlier, The Essence of Atonement by Banjin Dotan. And he points to something in this, and I'll just read a couple of lines from it. At the end, he says, "Atonement, the three refuges, and the three pure precepts are not apart from falsehood caused by delusions, yet we are able to attain liberation within delusion. Before delusions leave, true reality has arrived." So these delusions we speak about, and every day in our sutra service, we do the gatha, or the little verse of atonement. And we admit to ourselves that we are run by what we call the three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And sometimes ignorance is translated as delusive certainty. And certainly for me, there are lots of people who come to mind these days when I think about delusive certainty, including myself. I think I know what's right and what's best, and so do all those other people who disagree with me. Greed, the wanting mind, which is so pervasive, hatred, ill will, antagonism. These three poisons, so-called, are part of what it means to be human. They are part of what it means to be a Buddha. Just as much as being a Buddha includes being unwell, being a Buddha also includes being greedy and angry. Being a Buddha includes having delusive certainty, being lost in our own opinions, being confused and turned around. We don't like these things. We don't like the three poisons, and we don't like ill health. We don't like aging and death, perhaps. Well, maybe certainly. We don't like being separated from those we love. This is just the way it is. How can we understand that these things are the Buddha, the awakened nature? Well, a little hint maybe in what Martin Luther King said, that he finds hatred too much of a burden. And the burdensome nature of these three poisons is a pointer, it's a clue to how to practice being a Buddha, where Buddhahood includes everything and excludes nothing. This quotation from Banjin Dotan talks about how the three refuges, that is, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and the three pure precepts, which are avoiding evil, practicing good, and saving all beings. These six things alone would be enough to occupy us for a lifetime. And this avoiding evil is an important element here. Some Zen communities try to soften that line with various kinds of translations, but the teachers of Boundless Way decided to keep it as part of our version of the three pure precepts, avoiding evil, and avoiding it in the sense of recognizing it when it appears in us as well as everywhere else it appears. And then that recognition allows us to practice good, which means that we choose the less burdensome of the options as best we can in the moment. We avoid evil, we practice good, and thereby we save all beings, because this saving is simply the recognition that we can open our hearts to every kind of thing that arises, without exception, including our own darkness, including our own mistakes and the times we do harm to ourselves and others. The person who met my friend on the path, who said, "Do you think maybe you're not practicing correctly?" In a way, she did some evil there. It was a terrible thing to say to somebody who is having a recurrence of cancer. Maybe this is your fault. Maybe you didn't do your life right. But this doing evil, if that woman were able to open her heart to the unskillfulness of that statement, that's the meaning of atonement. Not just to say I'm sorry, but kind of to go, whoa, what did I just do there? What did I say that hurt someone? What did I do that shamed them? What did I do that missed the wholeness of the person right in front of me who is suffering? This is what it means to avoid evil, not to scoot around it, but to stand in front of it and go, what is this? And similarly with greed and with anger and with ignorance, what is this? And in the great vehicle teachings in the Mahayana, we say that because everything is Buddha, everything is this awakened nature, manifesting itself sometimes in a very limited, narrow, and we might say conventionally harmful way, everything contains the seed of Buddhahood as it is. And we say that greed contains the seed of kindness, because greed is just a moving forward towards something that we, in our limited way, believe will make us happier. But the activity of moving forward, it's greed when it's narrow, and when it becomes spacious, it's great love and kindness. Something is wrong, and I want to move towards it. I want to see what it is and maybe what I could do. This evening, just between the end of dinner and the beginning of this Dharma talk, 3 bodhisattvas appeared in my room, or in the kitchen, in various places actually, and offered me kindness, ideas, proof that they'd been thinking about me and my poor little nose, sniffling. Wonderful, touching, so touching. I'm so grateful to you 3. And even though I rejected the first 2 options and accepted the 3rd, in some way I accepted them all as a demonstration of a coming forward as love, as great kindness, as I want to fix this for you. I love you so much. I just want things to be better. And I hope you can see how the little kernel of greed, when it expands, becomes this kind of loving, caring for the world. My fantasy is that Martin Luther King, when he talks about love, is talking about something like this. He saw that his own people, people of color in this country, were suffering terribly. And I'm sure it made him want things to be different. I know that it did, because he decided to do something. He reached forward in a gesture of love and strength, which brings us to anger, ill will. He confronted this over and over and over again. People just hated him. If you've ever been in a leadership position and people appear to hate you, I think that's nothing compared to the way people hated Martin Luther King Jr. So much so that someone actually took a gun and killed him. This kind of ill will, it's so pointed and narrow. It doesn't see much. It's almost blind. It only sees what is in front of it that is disliked, that is despised, that is hated. And we all have little versions of this, mini versions, here at the Sesshin. The person next to us who is coughing, maybe a little bit of ill will arises. Stop that! Don't cough on me! Or moving and interrupting my pristine meditation practice. Or whatever. This ill will that arises, it's perfectly natural, and when it's narrow like that, it can be quite painful for ourselves. As Martin Luther King said, a burden. I don't like, personally, feeling ill will. It makes me feel heavy and uncomfortable. And yet, it arises. But the teaching, the great vehicle teaching, is that if we stand with it, if we be one with it, if we witness it, if we get to know it, and it begins to expand, it expands into wisdom. A clear and spacious seeing, a knowing about what to do and what not to do. A capacity to move into the world, like Martin Luther King Jr. did, to care for the world, to seek justice, to right wrongs, to, as the song from the Broadway musical Man of La Mancha says, to march into hell with a heavenly cause. This is the transformation of anger into the sword, we say, of wisdom. And then there's delusive certainty or ignorance, which in its little bitty form is just like lostness and opinions and getting lost in the way our minds are and just believing everything we think. And as that becomes spacious, what grows in us is a sense of equanimity and balance. In its littlest version, we're lost. In its biggest version, we're completely at home in the world with whatever arises, because we know that everything arises and everything passes away. And as Shinryu Suzuki has been telling us, we can sit upright in the middle of it all. This sitting upright, this is our practice. And then we move out into the world. And as best we can, we witness the places where our hearts and view becomes narrow. And through the practice of sitting, we watch how it expands and opens. And then maybe we can do something for this hurting, burning world. Maybe our offer will be rejected. But we have to know that making the offer is the whole thing. Making the path one of offering kindness, wisdom, offering the fruit of our own balanced, equanimous nature that is our birthright, that is the Buddha nature, in one of its manifestations. So, listening to Suzuki Roshi once again and hearing his words through this lens, that the Buddha nature is not what we think it is, but includes everything with no exception. The understanding passed down from Buddha to our time is that when you start Sazen, there is enlightenment even without any preparation. Whether you practice Sazen or not, you have Buddha nature. Because you have it, there is enlightenment in your practice. The points we emphasize are not the stage we attain, but the strong confidence we have in our original nature and the sincerity of our practice. We should practice Zen with the same sincerity as Buddha. If originally we have Buddha nature, the reason we practice Zazen is that we must behave like Buddha. To transmit our way is to transmit our spirit from Buddha. Thank you. Well, please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma time. Did you raise your hand? Yes.
Thank you for your very inspiring talk. I want to make an announcement. My daughter turns 20 today. So she's been with me all day. Her father, who's having a bad friend's cold.
a bad what?
French cold.
Like we have French flu. Cold?
There's an influenza in France.
Oh, it's called a French cold. Wow. Yeah, I love that.
They're having a big feast.
Oh, how great. Wonderful.
Yeah, happy birthday to her.
Yeah. Yeah. 20.
Thank you so much for your talk. It struck me again, beautiful and useful and helpful reminder always to how quickly, how tightly, how narrowly my mind defines things and then gets stuck there. Having the idea this is what Buddha is, this is what enlightenment is, this is what Buddhism is, this is, maybe some of those ideas from decades ago. And just listening to you, the encouragement again to look closely and question.
Mm.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it really true? Just even the fact of questioning it brings something new to it, rather than just automatically accepting. Oh yeah, that's the definition. Oh wait, that's what I know what that is. No. And then mind rushes on to the next thing. Oh yeah, I got that one. Yeah. So, and I think the threads that you wove together, so that idea of like being so sure that I know and my mind, says, oh, I got that one. Watching how that arises in relationships with people and things that are going on in our country and in the world, and the mind so quick to decide how it should be. If I don't agree, or yes, if I do agree, just very watching how fast my mind decides and then holds on to that idea, that decision, that conviction is the word I'm looking for. Seeing so clearly right now in our country that we have people that clearly have very strong convictions that are completely, at least to me, they seem completely opposite. And trying to hold that and not go toward, well, clearly they're wrong. And, that sort of self and other, and they're wrong, and they are because they think this way. And they're, of course, saying the same thing about me and my ideas. And how do we live into this?
So,
thank you.
That one of the things about studying up a little bit on King again is knowing that he disagreed with people. He didn't just say, oh yeah, everybody has a point of view. There were people who wanted to kill anybody with a dark skin. And he disagreed. He said that was, but he didn't meet it with the disagreement. He didn't lead with that, but he kept that firmly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a model for us in these days to honor our own disagreement and this is wrong feeling, mm-hmm. without making the people who hold those opinions not human. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did so amazingly. I don't know how he did that, but I aspire to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's one place where he says, if we hate the people who hate us, they have won.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't mean to go along.
Right.
So fierce disagreement and standing up with incredible courage, but not condemning the other human beings who were holding those opinions. Yeah.
I love that term, delusive certainty. It's so much more helpful than ignorance for me.
Mm-hmm.
In November, the day after the election, I flew to Florida to be with my parents for 3 weeks because my mother was going through an operation. And both of my parents are very, very hardened Trump supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And I... just I love my parents, you know, and how that, just to see how the word delusive certainty is a very great pointer, because there's a comfort in certainty. It's such a, you know, and having that, to knowing that the world is like this, and anything against that is wrong, and having that rigid fundamentalist viewpoint creates sort of, yeah, a comfort for people. And so that it feels like I can be more compassionate with them, or people who disagree with me, because they're looking to be comforted by their truth.
That's right, yeah.
And, of course, you know, we're in that boat, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're looking to be comforted.
But I think how to avoid falling into some kind of moral relativism feels so important to me, because we can get into, well, they're just different worlds, and we just, everyone, I don't think that's good enough. I think that there are some actions that are more helpful and more harmful, and we need to discern, and we need to stand up for what is true. And find the most skillful way possible to do that. And I think he says to sit with confidence and sincerity. So confidence is not delusive certainty. Confidence also is required in our practice. You know, we have to sit upright. Confidence means, it comes from the root confidelis, with fidelity, with authenticity, and that is required, and that is not over against someone else. We don't have to make someone else bad, but we do need to trust what is deepest in our hearts and align our life with that. Yeah.
You're talking about you know, being enlightened, and it's interesting for me, because I was raised as a Christian, as a Catholic, and it's almost like I see my life as pre-Buddhist, and you know, some clarity, and then you know, when I became Buddhist, and then when I was practicing Catholic. And so my process has been to reclaim all that Catholic upbringing, with all the turmoil and the strife and the difficulty and the lost part of it, and seeing that as enlightened also.
Yeah.
You know, this sort of, rather than that wasn't the light, that wasn't, you know, the absence of clarity, and now I have clarity. because I found it through Buddhism, but that's not quite.
It's the same old thing all over again.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, because I'm sure I'm not alone, as someone who's started practicing and have an affiliation with another tradition, and now has one that seems better, you know. Yeah. Seems to contain the truth. So for me, I guess it's honoring and reclaiming all the past also, all the way back, as far back as I can, and honoring it all as enlightened but not aware of it at the time.
Yeah.
And therefore struggling and suffering.
Right. Yeah, not to discount the struggling and suffering. And some of the things that you were taught maybe were taught in a skewed way that didn't allow you to see their value, you know. But if you all the teachings of all the major religions, even when they get muddled somehow, you know, in fundamentalism, that there's a way that there's that same kernel in them. And so to turn towards your suffering around that allows the wholeness to be present, I think, in the same way. And that's a very important thing, I think. Yeah. Thank you.
I just would like to share that last time I was on retreat in October, I had the worst cold ever.
Sorry to laugh.
At first I was really upset because I so longed for the silence, and it was an inside dialogue retreat with a lot of practice and interpersonal practice, and to sneeze the whole time and just have flame everywhere was just... But what I found was that once I surrendered to having the cold, I mean, there wasn't anything I could do. It was a real help in being in the moment, because there was not enough time to even go to thinking much. It was everywhere. And then something in me decided just to follow it really closely. And I started noticing how the cold changed. Mm-hmm. And within the hour, for like 4 days, changing within the hour. Then there was the fever during the night. Then there was, and it was a very profound experience, actually, to be on retreat with the cold.
Well, my experience is very similar, and I would even say moment to moment. Yeah. You know, sometimes there's a sensation in the left nostril, and then there's one in the throat, and then there's the sneeze, and it's just like it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
I'm beginning to want this. Yeah. Left out. Not really. Just kidding.
David has said, you should feel better soon so that you could kiss me. That's his reward for me getting better. Yeah, it sounds great, right?
Well, it of course it speaks to the content, that we don't get to choose the content of the moment. It appears, and we don't even have to like having a cold, but if that's the content of the moment, this teaching is that it's happening right here. This impermanence, this flashing, this phenomenal flashing, and that every circumstance has everything we need to wake up.
Including, and I think you're implying this, I don't want to have a cold. Yeah. That's the Buddha nature manifesting as, I don't want to have a cold. You know, that it's really important, right? Steve and I were talking about this, like what if, you know, to practice as if this body right now, in the condition it's in, is the way it's going to be forever. So how could I live like this? Well, the thing is, I'm alive right now. This is how you live like this. And sometimes there are these waves of all kinds of stuff. And people who have chronic conditions do have to make that, you know, it's not just going to be 4 days or 4 hours, right? It's going to be, but even within that, it changes minutely. And so our practice is to live fully as we are.
And then if I can turn it around and quote Melissa and say, so even this cold, we could have this cold for the rest of our life, right? Who knows how much longer it's, you know, we could be hit by a bus tomorrow and the entire rest of our life we have this cold, right? So what would I want to do with this last day of my life in spite of the fact that I have a cold? Right? It makes the cold seem so insignificant, right? And this challenge of fully living our life in spite of the circumstances, and we really can, right? We can really bring ourselves to our life regardless. Mm.
It reminds me of someone we knew, a professor, died suddenly. He was fairly young, and someone said, oh, it's such a shame, he was due for his sabbatical next year.
I sometimes think too, I don't know, those of us who are on the long trail of the retreat, you know, this is like the Appalachian Trail, and some people come on for a little bit and then get off, but there are the through hikers, we call people who are here for all 3 weeks through hikers, and just sometimes, I don't know if the other through hikers have this experience of, maybe maybe I shouldn't have signed up for all 3 weeks. This has been enough. I could really use a little, I don't know, go to the movies, have a nice meal at a beautiful restaurant, something. Although, it's pretty close, isn't it, in the kitchen? Not the movie part. Beautiful restaurant. But I was actually, I have to admit, having that thought myself earlier today. And then I thought, okay, so could you actually be here in the retreat and be free of any obligations to the retreat, you know, just in this moment? Could you just live, have your sabbatical now? And it turned out to be possible. It didn't, probably from the outside, it probably didn't look any different. But from the inside, it was like, oh, just sitting. Well, wow, this is a nice thing to do. Sniffling, sneezing, not so nice, et cetera. Just going on and on and on. We can have this freedom. This is what we say, freedom, in the midst of our lives, not waiting for the sabbatical. And Joanne?
The long trail versus the, you know, I don't know, something that feels more like maple syrup weather or something coming and going has been not anything what I thought it would be. Definitely, I mean, I'm fascinated by the tides and by how the sap runs only if the temperature rises and falls and rises and falls in the 24-hour period. And so to be here and you guys are like the planet. And I don't know what the hell I am, but it has just been remarkable. I mean, the whole river analogy and the sap flowing and the tree, it just happens to it. And then the whole, I was not thinking about this before, the whole boiling it down, jeez Christ, it is just so mind-blowing. And
you're the sweetness.
Well, that's the whole, like, craziness of it. Where is the sweetness?
Speaking.
Where is it? It's like, right, it's, yeah.
It's you. Yeah. It's you.
Yeah.
What if that were true?
But it's not just me.
Oh, no.
Of course it's not.
Right. Esther said that the other day. It's not personal.
Wild.
It's not personal.
Last year I came every night. This year, whatever, I'm coming a lot. It's more.
Yeah.
I didn't know what more would be like. I thought it would. I didn't even think what it would be like. And,
well, you know what, Joanne? You couldn't know. You couldn't know what it would be like because it's completely unpredictable. The only thing that's predictable is the form. You know, 6 o'clock in the morning. 10
well,
o'clock,
I think of you all.
2:30. Yeah.
You know, when I accidentally wake up, I'm like, oh, everybody's waking up now. not in an obsessive way.
Now I feel ill will arising.
Joanne's probably sleeping now. Where is she?
Ding, ding, ding.
Joanne, what I'm trying to point out is that the flavor of the syrup is unpredictable. There's too many things that go into it. But the thing that we can count on about the syrup is that it's sweet. And this Buddha nature, in spite of the fact that it comes in all shapes and sizes and flavors, and sometimes even bitter and sour, there's this fundamental sweetness to it. And you're right, it's not just yours. But it is our birthright. This is what Suzuki was talking about, and it's what how I feel. Yeah. Maple syrup. I had one thought earlier today. I had a wonderful soup for dinner, those of you who were here, a sort of version of a gazpacho. And it's a cold soup. And I pick up my bowl thinking that the bowl's going to be hot, and it's cold. And it took me a few minutes to... boy, I must be really sick. I'm listening. And then
I put cheese in mine to melt the cheese.
I hadn't figured out it was cold. It didn't work so well.
But I have to say that there's a line in one of the chants we do, Spring Everywhere, that says, it's the plum blossoms that bring the spring. Once you understand that, you know that spring is everywhere. And I thought, oh, it's the gazpacho in winter that brings the summer. It was just like, wow. So, with that, no, on that note.
Yeah, right. Sit with
come
that.
Come for dinner.
what? Just a quick one.
Okay.
When you're looking for Martin Luther King quotes, that they had the new monument, fairly new, in D.C., and they have quotes on the walls. Oh. And one of them I recognized from the Dhammapada was, hate doesn't end by hatred, but
only by love.
But I guess it was also a Martin Luther King.
No, that was one of the ones I found.
Yeah. Okay.
It's almost word for word.
Yeah.
Same as the Dhammapada. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
He says it in his own way. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you all very much. Back to sitting.